Right, the Confession of Faith, we're up to chapter 24 of Marriage and Divorce. It follows on the chapter of the Civil Magistrate. And it too is dealing with what we would call an ordinance of nature. This is something that it pertains to nature. It's not something of grace. The Roman Catholic Church, they're not really Catholic. It's an oxymoron, isn't it, to call yourself Roman Catholic? Their doctrine that marriage is a sacrament undercuts the teaching of the Bible and the legitimacy of marriage for anyone who's not a member of the Roman Church. And if you don't think that that's really their intent, know this. If you are not married in the Roman Church, and at some point you wanted to join the Roman Church, you have to have their approval to your marriage. They've got to sanction it in some way. They have to express sanction. So in the eyes of the Roman Church, if you're not married by them, your children are bastards and you're disinherited, there are all kinds of other implications. Nonetheless, we reject that. We know that marriage is not a sacrament. Let's look at section 1. Marriage is between one man and one woman. Neither is it lawful for any man to have more than one wife, nor for any woman to have more than one husband at the same time. So, first of all, we're going to talk about this proposition. I think when I first started going over the confession, it never really occurred to me that the divines would be somewhat prophetic in their denunciation of sin in expressing very clearly that marriage is between one man and one woman. It seemed to me that that was simply stating the obvious. However, we've come to a time and a place where the obvious is no longer obvious, and the idea of fixed standards of morality no longer apply and need no longer apply. So it's a good thing, I suppose, that the confession has struck such a clear note on this particular topic. Whatever I used to think that it was maybe superfluous, I now understand the depth of depravity and the unwinding of wickedness in our society is such that you simply have to conclude that it was necessary. So we're going to talk about that, marriage being between one man and one woman. And then we're going to talk about the next thing that we'll talk about is the fact that in marriage, it's not lawful for any man to have more than one wife or any woman to have more than one husband at the same time. And that idea of monogamy, we're going to discuss first, and then after that we will have some reason to address the issue of polygamy. We're going to have to address both of these issues. And again, at the time that the divines were writing, generally speaking, this was not a problem. Once in a great while, perhaps, you had a case of bigamy where you had someone with two wives, one in one town and one in another, something like that. But, you know, again, with the uncorking of every kind of bizarre perversion after the Enlightenment. America has given rise to its own, it's been called, I think rightly so, the America's Islam, Mormonism, which has as a central tenet this doctrine of polygamy. Now, I know nowadays they're going to say that doesn't apply to them, the third president of the Mormon Church, Woodruff, had a communication from Christ telling him that polygamy was unacceptable. That, however, is a communication that appears as an amendment in their book of the covenants and the Pearl of Great Price and the Doctrine and Covenants. And Doctrine and Covenants, they put that emendation in there. And of course, that revelation came conveniently right about the time they wanted to join the Union, and the federal government of the United States told them that as long as they accepted polygamy, that would not be an acceptable fit for the federal union. So conveniently, they had a revelation. However, you should know that the things that appear like that, and there's actually one other enactment, that is that the one that gave in the 70s that gave blacks the right to be included in the priesthood that they have. Those things are actually temporary enactments, and they're not considered part of long-term binding Mormon doctrine. So when you really push and prod them, they still really do have to acknowledge that, you know, polygamy is not a sin, that there's nothing untoward in it. You know, if they don't do that, it's a pretty big embarrassment to them as a church, especially since Brigham Young had dozens of wives. Anyway, we're going to talk about that. Then we'll talk about monogamy, and then we'll talk about polygamy. There are a lot of other questions that we're going to be talking about, the duties of marriage and all of that. That comes later. The doctrine of divorce, that comes later. But right now we want to lay the foundation of marriage in terms of what is taught in nature and in fact, what the Bible is enjoining. So, question one. Is marriage to be between one man and one woman? The answer is yes. We're going to begin with Genesis 2, verse 24.
Genesis 2, verse 24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh.
Yeah, so marriage as ordained by God, and again, he ordains this not as an ordinance of grace, but an ordinance of nature. It's an institution of strict fidelity between one man and one woman. And this is a point that Jesus himself, as we'll see, he comes back to this point. Right? In the face of the degenerative practice of the Jews, he comes back to this point. How did God establish this when he established this ordinance? What was his purpose in establishing it? We're not going to get into all the purpose of it yet, but we are going to look at how he establishes it. And the how is actually pretty clear. He's established it between one man and one woman. God is not a God of confusion. There is a biological necessity of an X and a Y chromosome to have children. There are a number of reasons that we will see when we look at the purposes of marriage that God has established it this way. However, we understand that there are a lot of people today who have imbibed the notion that this is not the case. And this isn't just a rejection of the Word of God, it's a rejection of the light of nature. It's unnatural. Anything contrary to this is not simply unbiblical, it's unnatural. It's a perversion. Right? It is an undermining of the order, the fundamental order which God has established in the creation. It's a striking at God's order. It's a slap at God's face. Thus, we can say that the libertines, sodomites, and whoremongers do grievously err, maintaining that marriage ought to be between those of the same sex, or despising that institution altogether. And this is really, we're fighting this on a number of fronts. There are people who think that that marriage is not necessary, that it's not the proper bounds in which there are to be marital relations. We call them marital relations. Sexual relations are marital relations. It's a mark of libertinism. It's a desire of whoremongers. It's the practice of whores to give themselves over, to indulge themselves in ways outside of or in despising of this institution. Make no mistake. It is a perversion, a further perversion, an unnatural perversion, when this relation is engaged in between two members of the same sex, particularly men. It is an inversion of natural order. It is a confusion. The sodomy is of such a nature that it is no different categorically than bestiality. In fact, the word buggery refers primarily to sodomy and secondarily to bestiality. That's a good old-fashioned word. Don't call them homosexuals or gay. Call them sodomites or buggerers. Now, we don't call people who are fornicating in a relationship. We call them whores and whoremongers. Right? Don't glorify what they're doing. Don't normalize their behavior. Don't sanctify with your talking about it the activity in which they're engaged. All of this is contrary to the institution of marriage, which God has instituted, as we're going to see later, for specific purposes. These are all things designed to encourage a certain type of indulgence that undermines the very purpose of the institution of God. Now, we're going to see that there are ways that people within the bounds of marriage violate the institution of marriage. But right now, we're just talking about ways that people who are not married violate this institution of God. God has set up marriage along strict and orderly lines. And it is to the everlasting shame of this nation and so many other nations that have been favored with the light of the gospel that they have allowed marriage to be hijacked by a bunch of godless, filthy, pervert, buggering sodomites. Now, the libertines, sodomites, whoremongers, and so on are confuted because, number one, it was God who made the race male and female. Genesis 1:27.
So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he them. Male and female created he them.
What a travesty it is, right? God created men, male and female created he them. And now we actually have people who are so perverted, so deluded, so demonic that they don't even know whether they're boys or girls. They don't even know whether they're men or women. You know, they're somewhere in between. Or maybe they're not even on the same sliding scale. We have so many accepted genders by, and I say accepted, they're accepted by the perverts who run the United States government and the governments of these various states. So many that it defies imagination. You can fill an entire section in a bookstore on types of gender. Look, the Bible's clear. God made men and women. By the way, that's not gender. If you know anything about language, words have gender. Nouns have gender. People are differentiated by sex. Male and female is a distinction of sex, not a distinction of gender. All of this language has been confused by a bunch of people who are hell-bent on foisting their perversion on everyone else and brainwashing generation after generation into thinking that what is abnormal and unnatural is, in fact, acceptable. Not only acceptable, but in many cases, preferable. Because they give preferences now. If you're a queer, if you're a sodomite, if you're some sort of deviant, we actually are supposed to give you preferences. We're supposed to give you special allowances and make special allowances. God has made the race male and female. And nobody, and especially no Christian, ought ever to question that fundamental building block of all human society. When he did that, he showed forth the unnaturalness of sodomitic sins. Look at Romans 1:26-27.
Romans 1:26-27. For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another, men with men working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet.
They receive in themselves that recompense of the error which was meet or fitting. It's no mistaking that all these violations of marriage, fornication, and sodomy, that they bring with them all kinds of horrible disease. That so many diseases have attached themselves to this. It's filth. It's like copulating with a pile of foul, diseased animal innards. It is disgusting behavior. And it should be seen as disgusting behavior. There is an unnaturalness, as I say, that's added when that fornicating is between members of the same sex. Now you've added to it another wrinkle of perversion. It was already a perversion. It was already a distortion, a total abandonment and despising of the institution that God has made in marriage. But when you add to it this other thing, it just underscores how much of an affront this sexual revolution that began in this country and in the Western nations in the 1960s, how absolutely godless and hostile to everything that is right and just and orderly it's been. It's been a total disaster. Right. Second, it was God who commanded, be fruitful and multiply. Genesis 1:28.
And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth.
Thereby he confounds sodomitic sterility. And by the way, we're going to talk about this more when we get to the purposes of marriage, but it's for this very reason. The use of birth control is when two people of the different sex basically embrace sodomy under the guise of their marriage. They've turned their marriage into a sodomitical institution, and they perverted it. We'll talk about that more when we get to that. But the fact is that sodomy itself is such an affront precisely because it's sterile. It thwarts one of the central purposes, as we'll see, of marriage. Be fruitful and multiply. God put this distinction between men and women so that they could procreate, not so they could fornicate, not so they could engage in acts of sodomy. There's a very specific reason the Bible tells us God did this. And the fact is that deep down inside, even the heathen understand this. You don't need the Bible to know that there's something wrong here. You may need the Bible to tell you what's right and how to bring a blessing to this institution, But you don't need the Bible to tell you when you're going far afield of this institution, when you're perverting this institution. Right, three. It was God who said it was not good for man to be alone, and fashioned and help fitted or meet for him a woman. Genesis 2:18.
Genesis 2, verse 18. The Lord God said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a help meet for him.
Right, and he didn't make him another man. You may have heard people say God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. God did not place man in a garden in order to pervert himself. Man did a fine job perverting himself on his own. You can't lay that at the feet of God. Man did not come forth from the hand of God tainted or perverted by sin. Certainly not twisted by this unnatural sin of sodomy. For the people who say, oh, I was born that way. Listen, friend. We were all born that way. We were all born sinners. We're conceived in iniquity and we go astray from the womb. It's no excuse to sin. It's no excuse to disobey the fundamental ordinances of God. God made a woman to be the help fitted for the man, not another man. Now, there's something implied in that, I think, and that is that if God had created another man, it would have been like being alone again. Thereby he condemned the unnatural affections of the filthy sodomites. Again, Romans 1, 26 and 27. I don't think we can read that verse, those verses enough.
Romans 1, 26 and 27. For this cause God gave them up into vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burnt in their lust one toward another. Men with men, working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet.
You know, I want to just say something to the charge that when two people of the opposite sex, when they fornicate, that is equivalent. It really isn't. It's not a good thing. It's a wicked thing. But what they're doing is not against nature. It's against the institution of God. But it's not against nature. God created a man and a woman. They're fulfilling a natural desire in an unlawful manner. But the desires of the Sodomites are unnatural. The actions of the Sodomites are unnatural. There's no moral equivalence that should be allowed when we're discussing this. You know, I've already begun to hear people say, well, you know, heterosexual people, they commit sexual sin too. Yes, they do. And it's wicked. It's an abomination before God. But it's not unnatural. What the Sodomites are doing is unnatural. What the Sodomites are engaged in is a total perversion of nature itself. All right, number four. It was God who brought the bride to her husband in the first marriage, Genesis 2:22.
Genesis 2:22. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from man made he woman and brought her unto the man.
Now that again is of, I think, great interest, or should be, because God not only created the woman, but then he brought the woman to the man and establishes this institution of marriage. God himself was the first father of the bride. He's the first one to give away his daughter, if you will, in marriage. And in doing so, he establishes an institution that makes normal. It is normative. Marriage is normative. The normal thing, the normal way to express these desires, the desire that man had being alone, the desire he would have that was met by this woman, God establishes that that desire will be met lawfully in this way, marriage.
Is that why when you read, you know, things back like the 1800s, back when, you know, marriage was still pretty normal, where people would look at unmarried men and think that they were possibly sodomites just because they weren't married?
It happened. I'm not sure how often, you know, if they're not in some way affected. I don't know that they were always going to get tarred and feathered with that charge. But generally, it was expected that the vast majority of children, boys and girls, would grow up and marry, that they would pair off. That was the general expectation, at least amongst Protestants. Now, the Roman Church actually perverted this. And this is something we talked about when we talked about oaths and vows. They perverted this through monks and nuns and this idea that we were going to have a group of people, a class of men, who all were put aside to be on their own, alone, outside of the bond of marriage, and that they were all going to be cloistered together, and the same with these women that they call nuns. So there is already in that the sowing of the seeds of something that's unnatural. What they're doing is they're denying a natural desire. And when you do that, you shouldn't be surprised you end up with a church full of pedophile priests. Because those desires are going to go somewhere. You know, when people have these desires, if you don't fulfill them in a lawful manner, it's going to be in an unlawful manner. So God brought the bride to her husband in the first marriage, thereby condemning those who despise this institution. Look at 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9.
1 Corinthians 6, verse 9. Know ye not that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Be not deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor abusers of themselves with mankind.
Right there. All of these things are condemned. Why? Precisely because God has given the parameters in which these desires that he's set in man. And he created man with natural desires. And he's then appointed the bounds in which these natural desires may be expressed. That leaves everything that is outside of those bounds condemned. 5, it was God's word declared for the ages that a man should leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. Genesis 2:24.
Genesis 2, verse 24, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh.
That's the division. That's when children leave home. That's when they go out on their own. They leave one house, one home, to establish another home. That's the proper time. And in fact, to encourage children to go out on their own prior to that is to encourage them to fornicate, to encourage them to engage in behavior that is contrary to this institution. Thereby, by establishing this, declaring that a man is to leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, condemns those that cleave to the harlot. 1 Corinthians 6:15-16.
1 Corinthians 6:15-16. Know ye not that your bodies are the members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them the members of an harlot? God forbid. What? Know ye not that he which is joined to an harlot is one body? For two, saith he, shall be one flesh.
Right. So, the fact is, again, Scripture condemns, God condemns, Paul here is condemning, cleaving to a harlot. Why? What's happening? Remember the woman that Jesus meets at the well? And you know, she says she's not married, and Jesus, the man she's living with is not her husband. But she's had all of these men, and in a sense, she's been married to all of these men. God has decreed, and we'll talk about this more when we get to the purposes of marriage, he's decreed certain purposes to be achieved within the institution of marriage. And when people fornicate, it has an undermining effect on the institution.
When you go into a woman, isn't that an act of covenanting itself? You're establishing a covenant?
When you fornicate.
Yeah.
Yes, taking carnal knowledge is in fact, is a form of covenanting on both sides. There's a cleaving. There is a cleaving, and it's a total perversion of the institution of marriage. It's a despising of the institution of marriage, but it's trying to emulate and simulate that marriage. And it has the same kinds of effects that you have within marriage. It has effects that you bear for the rest of your life. So that's why Paul doesn't want you to cleave to a harlot.
Does that mean then, like, if you go out and fornicate with one person, it's simple fornication. If the second person is involved, let's say you have a relationship with somebody or there's fornication going on, that ends, and you move on to somebody else, and fornication is involved as well. Is there then adultery involved as well? Because of this, like, you know, a little bit of...
No, not formally.
Okay.
But it's...
What's the difference between fornication and uncleanness? Fornication would be unmarried sex, when uncleanness would involve other kind of, like...
Fornication is any... The word fornication is a translation of the word pornea, from which we get the word pornography. It's any kind of sexual activity
outside of marriage,
the institution of marriage.
So it can go from the smallest thing to going all the way.
It's also going to include additional There are things that you can do within the bounds of marriage that are unclean as well. Right, we'll talk about that later, but that's not outside of the purview of our discussion overall as we're talking about marriage. But when the Bible speaks about fornication, generally, and I would think in almost every case, what is envisioned is that which is going on outside of the institution of marriage. But that does not mean that everything that goes on within the bounds of marriage is acceptable. All right, six. Jesus himself reinforces this divine institution, telling us that his Father instituted marriage in Matthew 9:4-6.
Matthew 19:4-6. And he answered and said unto them, Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh? Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder.
So, Jesus himself reinforces, and all these people now who are trying to find a third way or something in the church when it comes to sodomites. These are the same people, mind you, 20 years ago were saying, They were the big proponents of what would Jesus do. A lot of these are the same people, you know. These are the people who love the red letter Bibles. What would Jesus say? You know, forget about the rest of the Bible. What was most important was what Jesus said. You know, Jesus was the nice God, and the God of the Old Testament, he's the mean God, and all of that, and that kind of delusion that's behind dispensationalism. Right. Well, a lot of these people in the modern evangelical movement who've been influenced by all of this stupidity and heresy of past decades, now they don't even care what Jesus says about the institution of marriage. And now God has just been reduced to this proposition of love, and love has become God. It's not that God is love. Love now is God. And anything that is able to be covered with this umbrella that we call love, well, that's got to be acceptable. It's not acceptable. You know, wicked men love all kinds of evil things. Now, it's not really love, right? It's not really love. But they've set their affections on the things of this world, things that are displeasing to God, things which are contrary to the will of God. Point seven. Jesus accepted an invitation to a wedding in Cana, and there performed the first of many miracles bearing testimony to his divine sonship. John 2:1-3.
And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there, and both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus saith unto him, They have no wine. Verse 11. This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him.
Since marriage is an institution of nature, correct? Is it wrong for Christians to attend unbelievers' weddings as long as there's no service involved?
No.
No?
There's nothing wrong with it. The problem usually comes with the issue of occasional hearing. Kind of when, or participating in some kind of worship that is contrary to the Word of God.
Okay, so if you have pagan friends and they're getting married, but they're not religious, they're just going to get married, you can technically go and attend.
You can go. You've got to remember there are going to be a lot of things going on there.
True.
That are going to be, there's probably going to be drunkenness and dancing and things like that, which you shouldn't be anywhere near that. But the reception itself is not inherently wrong, and you know, there may be cases where there are other parts of it that are unobjectionable. Yes, it's an ordinance of nature. It's not. It's a very different situation in that respect. But that, you know, again, that said, it is interesting, I think, that the very first thing that Jesus does in his public ministry, according to John, is shows up at a wedding. That, in fact, what he does is impresses upon nature the blessing of grace. He presents himself in this situation and confirms all of this. Okay, let's move on to the second question. Is it lawful for any man to have more than one wife, or for any woman to have more than one husband at the same time? The answer is no. Again, looking at Matthew 19, 5 and 6, and also Proverbs 2, 17.
Let's see, Matthew 19, 5, and said, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh." Verse 6, "Wherefore there are no more twain, but one flesh, where therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder."
In Proverbs 2, verse 17, "Which forsaketh the guide of her youth, and forgetteth the covenant of her God."
Okay, so we're not speaking here of polygamy, which is successive, which is lawful. All right, it is, and we'll talk about that more. You can, in the case of lawful divorce, or in the case of the death of a spouse, you can remarry. That's a polygamy which is successive. That's lawful. We're speaking of a simultaneous polygamy, which is sin. And in fact, you know, a lot of times this is exactly what's going on with fornicating and fornicators. They're engaging in a form of polygamy. They've added that to their despising of the institution of marriage. They don't usually just have one partner, right? A lot of times there are a lot of other people involved. And this has become more and more common. Right? But here we're talking more specifically about polygamy as, you know, an institution where you've got more than one wife at a time.
I guess the polygamy would be at the same time, not throughout.
Yeah, you're talking about somebody like the Mormons or like the Muslims, who, you know, have 2, 3, 4, 10 wives. It's not that they're having an orgy. But the very fact that they are engaged to all of these people simultaneously, which is why I say in a lot of these cases where people are fornicating, they're not only despising marriage, but they're polygamous. Right? It's just polygamy, as we're talking about here, has the formality of trying to claim the institution of marriage to legitimize it. Therefore, the Anabaptists and Familists are maintaining it's lawful for a Christian not only to have more wives at the same time than one, but as many as he desires. Now, you may be surprised, living in Pennsylvania, you may think of the Anabaptists that we see as being very straight-laced and strict people who probably wouldn't do this. But at the time of the Reformation, it was not always so. This thinking that that was embraced in Mormonism and in certain other contexts. I've heard of it thriving. certain cults. It's really no different from what a lot of these Anabaptists were teaching at the time of the Reformation. So the Reformers had to deal with a lot of unstable people. The Familists were the family of God. They were sort of the Universalists of the day. They were big liberals, and they just didn't see. You know, if you want to love someone, it doesn't matter. You know who they are, or whether or not you're married to someone else. But again, they're confuted for the following reasons. Number one, because the having of two wives or many wives is contrary to the first institution of marriage, for the Lord gave Adam one wife only. We'll look at Genesis 2:23 and 24, Malachi 2:15, and Matthew 19:5 again.
Genesis 2, verses 23 and 24. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh."
Malachi 2:15. "And did not he make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one, that he might seek a godly seed? Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth."
Matthew 19, verse 5. "And said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh."
Right, so it's very interesting because Malachi raises a very interesting question, I think. He says, look, don't you think God could have made more than one? Why did he only make one? Could have made more than one. What was limiting him? Adam didn't have more ribs. What was the problem? Well, no, he could have. He could have done it. But he had a purpose, a different purpose in not doing it. Right? And the purpose has to do with this. He was seeking a godly seed. Now, this is something we'll talk about more in, I believe it's the next chapter, or the next section of the confession. This idea that he's seeking a seed for himself. Now, this is a problem. You know, when people fornicate, whose child is it? We don't always know. And I mean, fornication is so prevalent that people, you know, women get pregnant, they don't even know who the fathers are a lot of times. That's why you have paternity testing, to figure out who the father is. Well, that's not conducive to raising godly children and having a stable family. You can end up raising children that are not your own, having children that are not your own in your family. When I talked about the perversion of the priesthood earlier, Father Chiniquit, who left the Roman Church and became a Protestant, in his book, The Woman, the Priest, and the Confessional, talks about one time making a pastoral visit when he was a priest in Quebec, and sitting down at a table and realizing that some or maybe even all of the children around the table actually were not the children of the husband, but were the children of the priest who invited him to make the pastoral visit with him to this particular house. So the woman, the perversion of the priesthood was this priest had evidently impregnated this woman numerous times, and this man was cuckolded. He was a cuck. He was raising up children that were not his. And so, God seeks a seed for God in establishing one man and one woman. So there's no confusion here. You know whose children they are. you have children who know who their parents are. And how often do you run into people now, they don't even know who their parents are. And that messes them up forever. It just messes them up. If you don't know who your parents are, you're never going to be normal. You can't be normal. You need to know who your parents are. But we have this crisis in our society now because the institution of marriage has been despised. And we have people who are having all kinds of problems, experience all kinds of issues because they don't know. And you don't have very many people who think that this is even a big problem now. A lot of these government officials think that it's just fine, you know, and they teach me, well, it's fine, I have my mother. Of course you have your mother. But you need to know your parents. If you don't know them, and you had the opportunity to know them, and you don't know them, it's going to have a deleterious effect. Not only on you, but on future generations. It's going to carry over. The disintegration of marriage doesn't just affect the two people who were married. It affects the children and the children's children. It has an effect. And the more severe the situation, the more severe these effects are going to be. Now, it's not one size fits all. Not everybody is affected to the same degree. There are all kinds of other factors. You know, it's different when one of the parents is taken away by death. That makes a very big difference. But when you've been abandoned, or when you've been told that, you know, you've got another parent out there, but it's not important, that is child abuse.
What does this mean for situations like adoption? I'm assuming there are times when adoption is an okay thing, but it seems like there's a ton of cases in adoption where the biological parents of the children, even as the child is growing up, really don't want to be involved at all. There's kind of this, I don't want to mess up what's going on over there kind of situation. Is that, I'm assuming that's a really not a very good thing.
No, it's not a good thing. It's one thing to be adopted because your parents were killed. That is something that's already a trauma. You know, it's already going to be a difficult situation. But when it's, when you know you weren't wanted by one or both parents, that's going to add another wrinkle altogether. Very difficult thing, and it takes a lot of dedication to overcome that. I would think you would need to have a very stable home in which to introduce children who are coming out of that situation. Because you're really fighting an uphill battle in a lot of respects. So God is very careful in establishing this because he's looking for something particular. And if it could come in some other way, if it came through all of these relations, you know, what he's seeking, a godly seed, a seed for God. If that could come in some other way, he would have established it that way. Right? But he established it this way because this is the way most conducive to the end. In fact, it was the way that would have guaranteed it had man not fallen. Right? Only the introduction of sin has made it less than a sure thing. Two, because the law of God forbids expressly bigamy or two wives. Look at Leviticus 18:18.
Neither shalt thou take a wife to her sister, to vex her, to uncover her nakedness beside the other in her lifetime.
Yeah, God doesn't, and we're going to talk about forbidden degrees of marriage later on in this chapter. I don't want to get into that. But God does not sanction having two or more wives. I mean, if not two, certainly not three or four or more. It's vexing to the wife you have to have another wife. It's going to cause trouble. Look at the trouble that you see happening among the patriarchs because of the polygamy there. You get some sense from that of the problem that you're going to run into. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, but it is something which causes trouble. And remember what Solomon says, he who troubleth his own house shall inherit the wind. You know, by bringing in these other people. And by the way, you know, fornicating, all of your fornicating brings into subsequent marriage situations all of those people. They're all there. And you've troubled your own house by that. Right? Be aware of that. This is why you don't want to engage in that kind of behavior. I know everybody thinks that the church, it's so prim and proper and all their concerns. Why, it's just ridiculous, their concerns. No, you bring all of that baggage. And you can't really escape it, you know. It has a particular effect on men, has a particular effect on women. Affects both of them in different ways. And that is going to be reflected in the marriage. It's going to be there. The more aggravated the situation, the worse it's going to be. It's going to be there. All right, three. Because the Lord does find fault sharply with polygamy or many wives. Malachi 2, 14 and 15 again.
Malachi 2, verses 14 and 15. Yet you say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant. And did not he make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit. And wherefore one? That he might seek a godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth.
Yeah, there are actually a number of places in the Old Testament, beside the fact that the original institution was between one man and one woman, the prophets do inveigh against polygamy from time to time, and criticize and denounce the looseness with which the Jews came to treat the institution of marriage. And Christ himself finally addresses that when he is on earth. All right, four, because Christ says, he that puts away his wife except in the case of adultery marries another, commits adultery. Matthew 19:9.
Matthew 19, verse 9. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away doth commit adultery.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of the some of those issues surrounding divorce and remarriage when we get to those sections. I don't want to talk about it right now. But the point right now is this. It were lawful to have at one time more wives than one. He shouldn't be guilty of adultery and marrying another, whether he put away the former wife or not. Right? So it wouldn't be an issue. But it is. It's an adulterating. Anything, and you have to understand, adultery means that which adulterates. It destroys the purity. So any behavior that you engage in that undermines, despises, or contravenes the institution of marriage is actually adulterating that marriage. Right? But when you have another person, now you're striking at the very core principle, if you will, of marriage, that there's one man and one woman, and you don't have that any longer. You've done away with that. All right, five, because bigamy and polygamy take away the true peace of a wedded life, as is evident from the examples of Jacob in Genesis 30, and just read maybe 10 verses at a time going through there.
Genesis 30, verses 1 through 10.
To the end.
And when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." And Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in God's stead, who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb?" And she said, "Behold, my maid Bilhah, go in unto her, and she shall bear upon my knees, that I may also have children by her." And she gave him Bilhah, her handmaid, to wife, and Jacob went in unto her, and Bilhah conceived, and bare Jacob a son. And Rachel said, "God hath judged me, and hath also heard my voice, and hath given me a son. Therefore called she his name Dan." And Bilhah, Rachel's maid, conceived again, and bare Jacob a second son. And Rachel said, "With great wrestlings have I wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed." And she called his name Naphtali. When Leah saw that she had left bearing, she took Zilpah, her maid, and gave her Jacob to wife. And Leah's maid, bare Jacob a son.
Verse 11 through 20. And Leah said, a troop cometh, and she called his name Gad. And Zilpah, Leah's maid, bare Jacob a second son. And Leah said, "Happy am I, for the daughters will call me blessed." And she called his name Asher. And Reuben went in the days of wheat harvest, and found mandrakes in the field, and brought them unto his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, "Give me, I pray thee, of thy son's mandrakes." And she said unto her, "Is it a small matter that thou hast taken my husband? And wouldest thou take away my son's mandrakes also?" And Rachel said, "Therefore he shall lie with thee tonight for thy son's mandrakes." And Jacob came out of the field in the evening, and Leah went out to meet him, and said, "Thou must come in unto me, for surely I have hired thee with my son's mandrakes." And he lay with her that night. And God hearkened unto Leah, and she conceived, and bare Jacob the fifth son. And Leah said, "God hath given me my hire, because I have given my maiden to my husband." And she called his name Issachar. And Leah conceived again, and bare Jacob the sixth son. And Leah said, "God hath endued me with a good dowry. Now will my husband dwell with me, because I have borne him six sons." And she called his name Zebulun.
Genesis 30, 21 through 30. And afterwards she bare a daughter, and called her name Dinah. And God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her, and opened her womb. And she conceived and bare a son, and said, "God hath taken away my reproach." And she called his name Joseph, and said, "The Lord shall add to me another son." And it came to pass, when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said unto Laban, "Send me away, that I may go unto mine own place, and to my country. Give me my wives and my children, for whom I have served thee, and let me go. For thou knowest my service which I have done thee." And Laban said unto him, "I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry. For I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for thy sake." And he said, "Appoint me thy wages, and I will give it." And he said unto him, "Thou knowest how I have served thee, and how thy cattle was with me. For it was which thou hast before, I came, and is now increased unto a multitude. And the Lord hath blessed thee since my coming. And now, when shall I provide for my own house also?"
Genesis 30, verses 31 through 43. And he said, "What shall I give thee?" And Jacob said, "Thou shalt not give me anything. If thou wilt do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep thy flock. I will pass through all thy flock today, removing from thence all the speckled and spotted cattle, and all the brown cattle among the sheep, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and of such as shall be my hire. So shall my righteousness answer for me in time to come, when it shall come for my hire before thy face. Every one that is not speckled and spotted among the goats, and brown among the sheep, that shall be counted stolen with me. And Laban said, Behold, I would it might be according to thy word. And he removed that day the he-goats that were ring-straked and spotted, and all the she-goats that were speckled and spotted, and every one that had some white in it, and all the brown among the sheep, and gave them into the hand of his sons. And he set 3 days' journey betwixt himself and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. And Jacob took him rods of green poplar, and of the hazel and chestnut tree, and pilled white strakes in them, and made the white appear which was in the rods. And he set the rods which he had pilled before the flocks in the gutters and the watering troughs when the flocks came to drink, that they should conceive when they came to drink. And the flocks conceived before the rods and brought forth cattle ring-straked, speckled, and spotted. And Jacob did separate the lambs and did set the faces of the flocks toward the ring-straked and all the brown in the flock of Laban. And he put his own flocks by themselves and put them not unto Laban's cattle. And it came to pass, whensoever the stronger cattle did conceive, that Jacob laid the rods before the eyes of the cattle in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the cattle were feeble, he put them not in. So the feeble were Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. And the man increased exceedingly, and had much cattle, and maidservants, and manservants, and camels, and asses.
So, the point of Genesis 30, a big point of it is that polygamy really was not conducive to marital bliss or marital peace. Not only did it cause problems between the wives and the concubines and so on, it also causes problems between Jacob and his father-in-law. There is tension there as well. The same can be said of Elkanah if we look at 1 Samuel 1:6.
1 Samuel 1:6, and her adversary also provoked her sore for to make her fret because the Lord has shut up her womb.
Yeah, and here you see Hannah and the other wife. The other wife, Elkanah's other wife, is needling Hannah because she's barren. She doesn't seem to be able to have children. And that it's the same kind of thing. You know, when you've got different wives, you've got different children who are all contending for the inheritance and a place in the household, and all of that becomes sort of a party strife. It's not just, you know, the kind of sibling rivalry now, but the siblings actually have different mothers, and they have different identities to some extent because of this. Different loyalties. Right, 6, because the invention of bigamy was the device of a wicked man named Lamech in Genesis 4:19. Yeah, so the first example of polygamy we have in the Bible is not in any godly line, but we're expressly told it arises amongst those who have departed from God, those who were out of the way. 7, it's against the nature of the marriage contract by which neither has power over his or her own body. 1 Corinthians 7:4.
1 Corinthians 7:4, the wife hath not power of her own body but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body but the wife.
Yeah, so how can that be when there are other people involved? And hence, he's convicted of injustice and treachery. He joins himself to another,
Malachi 2:14. Yet you say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously, it is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant.
Right. The 8th point, it's against the command of Paul, who wishes each wife to have her own husband, 1 Corinthians 7:2.
1 Corinthians 7:2, nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband.
And for that very reason, a wife is actually called an adulteress if she becomes the wife of another while her husband is still living. Romans 7:2-3.
Romans 7, 2 and 3. For the woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. So then if, while her husband liveth, she be married to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man.
Right, ninth, it's against the united care of offspring, which the end of marriage requires, and is divided in polygamy. By the way, a number of years ago, a former presidential candidate now wrote a book called It Takes a Village about raising children. And that sentiment is the sentiment of polygamists. It's a strike at the foundation of monogamy. Right? And when they say, well, that's a saying out of Africa. Yeah, and in Africa they still have a lot of polygamy. Right? And it has not helped advance those people in civility. It hasn't built civilization. It hasn't made them godly people. It hasn't made them productive people. It hasn't advanced them in any way. Monogamy has been the great engine of societal advance. Not just technological, but societal advance. All right, question three, then. All of this talk must raise some questions, right? What then of the cases of polygamy, laws regulating polygamy in the Old Testament? What do we do with all of that, then? Well, there are a few things I think we need to consider. First, the legality of polygamy cannot be gathered from the example of the patriarchs of the Old Testament who were polygamists and to whom polygamy may have been permitted. It appears that they may have been permitted, right? And that that they were polygamists, I don't think is really a question. The fact is this: we're to be governed by laws and not examples. All right? When the examples are clearly contravened by Scripture. Right, when the examples are not proven. In other words, if polygamy was an example among the patriarchs and we had we had some scriptural reasons to think that God approved of it and that God is finding this something not only permissible but actually a matter of approbation, that would be one thing. Then we would say, oh, well, then polygamy is not a bad thing. But the fact that it's talked about, that it existed, that's a reality into which the revelation of God's word comes. However, as the progression of revelation increases, the pressure to abandon polygamy also increases until finally when Christ comes, he reiterates the law as of the original institution in Genesis and makes clear that this is what he expects of his disciples.
And don't we have a pretty clear example, like after the flood, four couples come off of the ark? I mean, it's...
Yes, the ones that God saves from the old world are not polygamous, they're monogamous.
Right.
So you have a repristinating of the institution of marriage in them coming off of the ark. You have those kinds of examples, right? Two, if it was permitted, it was either permitted by an ethical permission of right through a particular dispensation on account of infirmity, because they were still babes, to whom many things were allowed which are denied adults, and this now ceases under the New Testament. For example, Galatians 3:24-25 and 5:21 and Hebrews 5:12-14.
Galatians 3, verses 24 and 25. Wherefore the law was our schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after that faith has come, we are no longer under a schoolmaster.
Galatians 5, 1.
Galatians 5:1. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again to the yoke of bondage.
Hebrews 5:12-14. When for the time ye ought to be teachers, ye have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk, and not of strong meat. For everyone that useth milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. The strong meat belongeth to them that are full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil.
Right. So that's one possibility, that there it's permitted because, just like you permit things to babies, that you don't permit to adults. Right? The idea that there's this progression. But it's probably more likely that the permission was just simply a permission of the deed. It was a mere toleration, though not through approbation. All right, these evils were suffered in the judicial law, but they were neither commanded nor approved in the moral law. And that's an important point. You know, even though some of these things are suffered in judicial law, the Bible recognizes certain evils in the judicial law. It suffers them, like slavery. All right, it's suffered. Is it really approved? Well, regulation is one thing, but approval is something else altogether. And you don't really have an approval of polygamy. You don't have a command. There's no indication it's approved in moral law. Look at Matthew 19:8.
Matthew 19:8. He saith unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so.
Right. So, you know, the whole issue of divorce, it's a toleration, it's a permission. It's not an approbation. Even though when we get to that, we're going to affirm that it is still a tolerated thing. That does not mean that it has the approval of God and that it ought to be normative. It's tolerated at best. Right, so that in this way, then, they might be free from civil punishment in the earthly court, but not likewise from the divine punishment in the court of heaven, from which they had to be freed by the grace of God, by the intervention of repentance, either explicit or at least implicit. Look at Psalm 19:12.
Psalm 19:12. Who can understand his errors? Cleanse thou me from secret faults.
Yeah. Now, in order to understand what we're saying here a little bit better, maybe understand, though he gives laws to polygamists, and he does, look at Deuteronomy 21:15-16.
Deuteronomy 21:15-16. If a man have two wives, one beloved and another hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, and it shall be, when he maketh his sons to inherit that which he hath, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn.
Right. You have to understand, what God is doing, he doesn't on this account approve of polygamy. When you're writing judicial laws, sometimes you have to deal with cases that arise because men are doing things that are wrong to begin with.
Would that apply to today as far as the magistrate's power, that they have the power to regulate some things?
Yes.
In
the things that situations and events and results that arise because of prior wickedness, they can.
Not yes. To approve it, but to weed it out and then regulate it until it's weeded out.
It's to try to bring some order back into an already disordered picture. Right? So, likewise, he gives a law concerning not bringing the hire of a whore into the house of the Lord, Deuteronomy 23:18.
Deuteronomy 23:18, thou shalt not bring the hire of a whore with the price of a dog into the house of the Lord thy God for any vow, for even both these are abominations unto the Lord thy God.
And by the way, the price of the dog, he's talking about sodomites. Sodomites are dogs. And that's, it's not to be brought in. That doesn't, just because he's put a regulation on not bringing the hire of a whore or the price of a dog into the house of the Lord, that doesn't mean he approves of the hire of a whore. Right? It's what do you do now? You know, you have this money. Now, this is an interesting question because this arose, this was debated at one point in the 19th century among covenanters, if you had stock in a company that did business on the Lord's Day. You know, was it okay if you just gave it to the church? The church said, no, you can't own stock in a company that does business on the Lord's Day. Don't you understand? You can't redeem that money now by just giving it to the church. All right? Same kind of regulation.
Would that also apply to, say, a company like Procter & Gamble, who they own tons of products, but they also sell birth control products? Would that still apply?
The largest stockholder in Italia, Pharmedica, which was the largest producer of birth control pills in Italy, was actually the Roman Catholic Church. But that should prove to you that that's absolutely forbidden. You shouldn't be holding stock in companies that are doing these kinds of things. It's wicked.
Quick question. So when it's talking about the hire of a whore, it's talking about a whore coming into the house of the Lord using the money that was obtained via the whoredom.
Yes.
So okay. That is that like crying Corbin?
It's more like, you know, trying to wash your hands of it all.
Right.
Likewise, he gives a law concerning the election of a king, and yet he doesn't approve of the desire of the people. 1 Samuel 8, 6 and 7.
1 Samuel 8, verse 6 and 7. The thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, "Hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them."
Yeah, so, in the body politic, such things were permitted and punishment not executed by civil power, but the law of God is the same. So there may be certain permissions that are given in the body politic. That doesn't mean that God approves. Right? We have to deal with situations that arise. Right. Next time, we're going to take up the purposes for which God has instituted marriage, and we'll be looking at that. Some detail.